Welcome to Cannon Fodder, a behind-the-scenes look at the Glass Cannon Podcast.
Welcome, one and all, to the 50th episode of Cannon Fodder. My name is Joe O'Brien.
And I am Troy Golden Jubilee LaValle.
That's it, buddy. It's a Golden Jubilee. So exciting, man.
Wow.
50 weeks of Cannon Fodder.
Why did I commit to this?
You have hated it the whole time. I've enjoyed some of it. I've enjoyed all of it.
It's a lot of fun. I think a lot of people enjoy it. But man, do we dig ourselves a hole with this extra commitment.
We certainly did. But I have to say, on its 50th birthday, we have to acknowledge the fact that Cannon Fodder started out as an idea of just a way to record the stuff we were already talking about after sessions.
Right.
And put it out there so people could listen to it. And it has become something that a lot of you have told us you really love. And we really, really appreciate that. It's what helps us to continue to do these week after week when we get messages from GMs saying, yeah, they're taking notes on this stuff. They're using this stuff in their games. When we get notes from people saying, I love that character build that you did. I tried it out. I literally took that character build into a game. Here's how it worked out. That kind of stuff is so fun, and there is no forum in the GCP proper for us to do that.
Yeah.
This is our forum for that.
We said on, I think, the first episode that the show was going to evolve to be what you, the fans, wanted it to be, and I think we've held true to that.
Yeah.
It really has, especially with listener mail. Like, we're trying to make the show something that is for you guys.
Totally. And it has become, early on, we said it would be part GM Academy.
Mm-hmm.
And then shortly after, I think it was by the time we were 10 episodes in, we realized it was also going to be Player Academy.
Yeah.
And we've just slowly tried to learn, get out there what we are consistently learning from our mistakes, from our game, from the games we run outside of Giant Slayer or playing outside of Giant Slayer. And all in all, I can't believe that it has been 50 weeks of this now.
Wow.
It is kind of an arbitrary number, as people always say, which I hate because it's not that arbitrary. 50 is a number that people always celebrate.
It's a milestone.
But we're coming up on a year.
Yeah.
I mean, we're coming up on a year.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Exactly.
You just said that.
Exactly.
Oh,
we're coming up on a year of Cannon Fodder. But hey, let's celebrate it at 50. I said on the previous Cannon Fodder that I had a surprise for you.
Yes.
Guys. And I told you about it, Troy,
before we were setting up. It's pretty awesome.
But I am going to save it for a little bit because it's just too good to give away too early. We'll do the episode recap, and then I promise I will announce it before listener mail.
Well, you know what then? I'm going to do my surprise.
Okay, yes. You told me you would counter with a surprise.
Well, it's episode 50, and you know what that means.
Yeah! I thought you were going to say character death.
We're up in the champagne room, motherfuckers!
I need a good drop for that.
I have had this bottle of champagne left over from the AMA. We went through like four bottles, and this one is just sitting in my fridge, and my wife is like, get that out of the fridge.
It's been in there for, 5 weeks?
It's still good. It's still good. It's been refrigerated the whole time. So I've got two giant glasses here, and I think, Joe, because I need to finish this, I can't store this champagne overnight. It has to be finished now. So Cannon Fodder does not end until we finish this bottle of champagne.
Sounds good to me, buddy.
Can you
agree
to that?
Sounds terrible for the listeners.
Yep.
Sorry in advance, you guys. But this is exciting, though. It's definitely, I mean, not just because it's episode 50, but because we are going to slowly get more and more intoxicated and say the things we're not supposed to say.
Right.
Which always makes good radio.
I might reveal, like, what's going to happen in 105. And I don't mean to do it. But it's just the bubbles.
It's not my fault.
It goes straight to my head.
Hey,
cheers,
cheers, buddy. A pleasure.
To 50 more.
To 50 more Cannon Fodders, bro.
Yeah, dude.
Go Sox.
Go Sox. Now, full disclosure, this is Prosecco.
I didn't notice that until I saw the label. I literally looked down. In my head, I thought, you cheap bastard. And then you said, it's Prosecco.
It's from the Prestige Collection. I'm sorry I don't have any peach puree for you to give a little fruity tingle at the bottom.
All right, well, let's get back to the meat of Cannon Fodder and
yep,
look back behind the scenes and recap episode 104 of the GCP.
A role-playing episode.
A full-blown role-playing episode. And yes, there are some times when we know they're coming, and there's some times when we don't. And as you said in the episode, reiterated, we did not really know what we were going to see in this episode. Mm-hmm. There was some thinking out there that we would be in combat, and there was some thinking that we might have to do some role-playing with maybe someone who was there against their will. And I will say, to the credit of you and... is it Tim Hitchcock? He's the writer, right?
Tim Hitchcock, yep.
It isn't so black and white as that. It's something that just kind of falls in between. Mm-hmm. She doesn't really seem like a slave, this woman, right? She's not an indentured servant, yet she follows something greater than just Orathosh and what he has going on here. Mm-hmm. She might have some different allegiances than just being a blind follower of Orathosh.
Yeah.
Am I getting that right?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think what I can liken this to is from, I think, episode 99, when you found that room with all the intel. This is like... You started to see the bigger picture of, you know, what's going on with the Storm Tyrant's army. With this conversation with Farron, you start to see the bigger picture of what's going on in the cathedral. What's
right.
going on within Minderhall's Valley. It's not all what you see. You keep uncovering these layers. Matthew always uses the onion motif.
Yeah.
Just keep peeling back that onion to find out more and more of what's happening behind these walls.
Yeah, and behind the scenes, I will tell you that I did not realize at the time we recorded the episode, I had not yet re-listened to 102. And I like to try to make an effort to re-listen before our next game, just to be as on point as I can be. But I was just too busy, whatever it was, I can't remember, but I didn't listen to it. And when I did listen to it, just right after... I didn't even put together during the session that what she was talking about, what was her name again?
Farron.
What she was talking about with this oracle under the forge was exactly what we had read in all the paperwork that we found with the maps and Pembroke's spell book.
Yeah.
We found this note that seemed to be written by Urathosh that says he was waiting for this person that was beneath the forge to die, that he wasn't going to move against her, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But he was going to wait for her to die. And I just, at that time, I think that I placed it a little far away in my brain space because I figured we would not be seeing the forge for a long time.
I think all of you thought that.
I think most of us, yeah, we didn't think the forge was in the cathedral. And that was a big part of this episode's debate was... where are we going?
Right.
You know, trying to assume or find out where the forge is and to get it all clarified. Well, I'm sorry, we were talking about that in 102, but to get that all clarified here is just, it was just really, really neat. And I don't think, honestly, you tell me if you feel differently, but I don't think we need to rehash over everything that was said. There was so much said in the episode from a plot standpoint, but...
I would just say you should re-listen to it again.
Oh, I'm yeah. All of the plays, I'm definitely going to re-listen to it.
There's a lot of information back and forth there, and like I had things that I wanted to get out, but a lot of it, it was fun to role play with Matthew. I haven't really role played one on one with Matthew
before. Yeah.
I mean, there really hasn't been a lot of role playing on my part since Shinnerman's Fortune, and obviously what we did in episode 100.
Because you're just playing all violent combatants,
right? Right.
Yeah.
So it was great to get back into those shoes, and like I hadn't had a good role play with Matthew. Probably since you guys were in True Now. So it was nice to do that again. I didn't know that's how it was going to turn out, like a woman-to-woman chat. And it was just fascinating to just kind of sit back and react to Matthew, because Matthew always asks great questions.
He really does. He cuts right to the chase on a lot of this stuff.
And what's neat is when you play role-playing games is sometimes, you know, especially when you're the GM creating these NPCs, you have an idea of how you want it to go, but it's not until you get in the room with the players and you start fleshing this character out as you're reacting to what the other players are saying, that you start to understand the character more by the decisions you make, but once you say those words. So Matthew asked me a question, and I'm thinking how I want to answer it. Once I answer it, now this character is coming to life in that moment.
You know, it's so funny you say that, because if you remember, we talked about this on Cannon Fodder a while ago. This is going to be like one of those clip shows, right? It's the 50th episode, so we'll go back to previous Cannon Fodders. Do you remember that? I'm 99% sure we discussed it on Cannon Fodder, but you said how you don't like how I can press you sometimes during character creation, asking you all these specific questions that you haven't fleshed out yet because you want your character to have much more blank spaces in their backstory or their creation that you figure out as you play,
right,
which I fully understand. But this, what you're saying right here, is the exact reason why I try to ask very penetrating questions very early in the character creating process. Because when you're forced to answer tough questions, you are forced into decisions.
Yeah.
And making decisions in character creation is so important. Mm-hmm. And I fully support the decision to leave things open. There are still massive gaps, 104 episodes in to Lork's story. There are years of his life that are unaccounted for on this podcast that could be filled with all kinds of interesting stuff.
Yeah.
But the point is that you want to make sure it is a decision that you're making and not just a lack of effort.
Right.
Those are two very different things. If you're going to decide this piece of my life, I'm going to keep blank to fill in later because it's going to help me to create the character better down the line or attach them more to the campaign I'm playing, I completely respect that. But I just bring that up because it just helps to reiterate how important tough questions are.
Mm-hmm.
When players are asking really good questions of you, that's when it forces you to create interesting story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Matthew,
and vice versa, obviously.
Matthew is a writer, I'm sure, in his daily process is asking himself these same questions as he writes, and he answers the questions through his writing. So I think that's what makes him such a, you know, unique role player, because he asks the same questions of me and of the other players. You know, that whole Della Will, conflict has to do a lot with Matthew's view of it and his questioning of what he thinks the demon's blood or the devil's blood is.
Yeah. And his ability to really get into Della's head, to get in the head of someone who's not from this plane, who doesn't really understand your morality, like your simple morality. And it's just, he thinks about things in a way that I never think about, which is part of the whole collaborative storytelling environment. That's what makes it flourish, is people are thinking of things that nobody else in the group is thinking of.
And that's why it was really fun to get into that, because I don't know, I for some reason I assumed it would be a Baron conversation. I just thought Baron would be up there and I'd be like, all right, here I am, just given just the facts, ma'am, you know, given
right
the information that I wanted to get out. But no, this was much more esoteric,
because it ends up being a stealth check by Della to get in there first.
Yeah,
so she's the first one that makes contact. And I can tell you from behind the scenes, I sat at my microphone. I was sitting right next to Matthew, across the room from you.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just looking at him, and he did not even take his eyes off of you.
Yeah.
He was staring right at you that whole exchange, and you could just tell he was in it. He was in the zone.
He really was. I mean, I felt like we were doing it. We were doing it improv together. But I mean, I really, sometimes
exactly
I'm
doing.
Just looking down, or I'm like trying to get into the physicality of it. I was just looking at Matthew and having a conversation. And there were some things I knew I was going to say, and some things I just made up on the spot. And that's when role playing can really transcend just the game, when you're creating these lives. And now this is canon. Everything
right.
I said, even if I didn't mean to say it, is now part of the story.
Can you think of any one particular thing that you made up on the fly that you really liked, or that is now canon that was...
I'd never tell you.
Yeah, I guess. Well, that goes back to your theory that you never tell the players what's in the AP versus what you added to the AP.
Right, right. Yeah, it wouldn't be as fun for you. But well, I will say, listen back. Definitely listen back. I can't wait to listen.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to listen back. And also, I have to say, on the Sir Will end as well, it was nice for Sir Will to get back a little more classic role play.
Mm-hmm.
He was role playing as a religious character with this other religious character.
Yeah.
There was some interesting back and forth there about, because her being so zealous, that has a negative connotation to it, but so pious, maybe, in her service of this oracle,
mm-hmm.
that she believed in her and was going to follow her leadership and do whatever she needed. And Sir Will is missing a little bit of that focus right now, that clear leadership that is unquestioned that you follow. And so there was a little bit of inspiration there for him to see that, to have that conversation. I just love that image of Sir Will looking up at this 14-foot woman, and he's 3 feet, 3 inches tall.
So cool. I mean, this is when I wish it was a cartoon, because I would just love to see that image of him looking up. And it's very interesting.
Fully armored and everything, you know? It's just,
think about it. Like, this woman came here to try and discover the roots of her ancestry. She was on a quest. Do you know what I mean? And she discovered Minderhall along the way, in a way. Like, I'm sure her ancestors were followers of Minderhall, but she's kind of getting into it. She's kind of learning from the Oracle. It's a lot like Lork in a way. You know, Lork found Gorum along the way in his travels.
Right.
So this is just, this story could be told through Feren's eyes. It would be I'd love to see that story. So yeah, it was just very interesting. And then Umlo, of course, is like Nestor pulling him out of the room.
Oh, he fails the check, which is great.
Like, I gotta get out of here.
So all of that stuff was really fun. And then bringing up, though, the advancement of the plot, which now it's just so perfectly interesting. And this is why, and I hate to sound like such a shill, but this is why it's like, play these Pathfinder APs. And I'll tell you why. Because when we went into Red Lake Fort, we were in there to stop a giant from uniting the orcs with giants and sweeping down and taking over the world, right? That's what we were up against. That's what we thought we were up against. We get in there and we find a broken woman whose attempts to please a greater lord of giants have failed. And she is now scattered to the wind as far as leadership is concerned. There's all kinds of infighting, and we're able to make allies for at least some time out of these orcs. You're seeing a similar thing here where we think it's so cut and dry. We're going to go into this valley. We're going to find the giant responsible for bringing together the whole giant army, and we'll nip it in the bud here. Nope. Once again, we're dealing with a priest of sorts, a leader of sorts that is just one training camp.
An
inquisitor that is just one training camp of this whole big picture, and there's someone in there who disagrees with him philosophically, and there is a split. But they can't fight each other because it would be very uncouth or whatever, or irreligious, or a stain against Minderhall. So the layer of depth that you get makes... I'm infinitely more interested to play in 105 than I have been in a while, simply because now it's just not so cut and dry. Where's the huge bad guy, and let me go find him and kill him?
Well, one of my favorite things to do is to listen, what you just did, like listen to the players piece out what they know so far and what they think they know. And what you just did there, I just got really excited, and it made me think of things I hadn't thought about. Because hearing what you guys latch on to and what interests you allows me to sort of pivot my focus on take my ideas and pivot them either to go along with where you're thinking or completely subvert from what you're thinking, just to create more conflict.
Well, usually you completely subvert.
Usually I subvert. but I will say, with no spoilers, I think 105 is going to be one of those great Glass Cannon episodes.
All right.
I am really, really excited. I did not think 104 would end where it ended.
Really?
I did not plan for that at all. I shouldn't say at all. Very, very small.
So then you're a terrible GM.
No. Well, I thought maybe you'd get there 105, 106, maybe. I didn't know. I didn't think that was going
to happen. Yeah, I think Grant was a big part of the push to just go. He was like, we should just go right now while we know that it's daytime. They're not doing the ritual, whatever, the service in the evening.
Yeah, and Farron was like, you got to go now.
Right, exactly. You told us, and we just said, let's just do it.
But you get into that room. You were talking last week about the size of the Grog Hall. How about the size of the cathedral?
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, you were able to sneak by three creatures.
So we're on roll 20, right? Troy, I am not even kidding you when I say that I thought that all of that stuff you were talking about us overhearing, it was like training of initiates or acolytes or something, right? What was it? It was like we were
like
over
swearing and recruits.
Right, swearing and recruits. We're overhearing the swearing in of recruits. I am not even kidding. I did not even tell you this. I literally thought that that was all theater of the mind, because I was looking at a massive map and there were no creatures on it. And it wasn't until almost the very end of the episode, because Sir Will was not really involved in that whole part, that I scanned over and saw that like another 150 feet away, there was a whole group of giants in that open room. I thought that they were in that room somewhere, but you didn't put them in there because it wasn't really going to be a combat thing.
You're underestimating. It was probably 300, 400 feet away.
It's just bonkers. But and we keep reiterating it to just give you guys a sense of scale. You have to understand how big this place is compared to these tiny, tiny PCs.
So imagine on, I don't remember, it was 96, 97, when Nestor looks into that room and sees the service, and that room is full of giants sitting on stone benches, taller than any human being.
Mm-hmm.
And now it is completely empty, save for these recruits and their general or whatever down the other end of the room that was so far away that even with, you know, I don't think all the stealth checks were that great. I think Baron had a couple low rolls there. You know, obviously Della was able to vanish and get you guys up there for the most part, but you were still able to get up there, open a secret door, and
But vanish does not silence a cavalier's full armor and his mount's full armor.
Right.
And you took that into account, and you were just like, they're so far away that if they can't see you right now, even hearing you is going to be such a far distant little just jingle in the distance. They're not even going to notice it.
Yeah.
And I thought that you were just doing literally theater of the mind until I saw that they were actually there on that map. That's how big it was.
I was surprised that one of you wasn't like, I want to go fight him. I'm going to fight him. Or like Nestor taking a shot. But I mean, I think even Nestor on the top of that platform with his bow trained on them just to make sure no shenanigans went down was outside of his first range increment.
Yes.
That's how far.
Yeah, over 200 feet.
Yeah, it's just so cool. And again, I kind of thought there'd be a fight there or maybe you guys would tackle it a little bit differently, but I'm telling you, 105, man. 105 is going to be special.
You heard it here first, guys.
What do I know? I'm half a bottle into champagne.
All right. Well, I don't think there's much more to talk about here because I don't
want... We'll see you next week.
I don't want to speculate over what this person is or is going to say, but just her... It is a her, right?
I think so.
Just her tease at the end of the episode is enough to be like, oh my God! Like, I'm just so excited for another Oracle situation. I don't want to go too far down that
road,
though.
The description of that room alone was 10 minutes long.
It was. That's what I need to re-listen to.
Yeah.
Because at that point, I was so distracted and just trying to figure out what is going on here that I need to re-listen to all of the things that are going on in that amazing room before we find out that she knows us.
It was a cool moment for me too, because as I was, you know, describing it all, I was watching you guys and you were all forward in your seat. And that's a fun moment as a GM when you know that everybody is, they're into it. They're really like hanging on every word, just trying to visualize this scene. And as fun as I said before, as fun as it would be for this to be a cartoon, there's something cool about it being, you know, a completely auditory experience, just because you're allowed to picture it any way you want to picture it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think it's time for my announcement, Troy.
Oh, you want some more champagne there, John?
Why do you fill me up with a little champagne there, Troy?
I can't drink it all by myself.
Don't spill it.
Happy 50th to you, Cannon Fodder.
Guys, if you're out there and you're not driving a car, or hell, if you are driving a car, pour a little champagne.
Yeah, if you live in the Bible Belt, go for it.
They don't have laws against that kind of stuff.
No, there's no other cars on the road.
So, this all comes back to a little thing that we do in our game called the Bottle Cap.
Bottle Cap.
Bottle Cap. Now, where did this start?
In my knowledge, it started with our buddy, our friend Chris Merwin, who was the first GM that I played with when I got back into this through you, and that's where I met Skid and everything.
So Chris was running us through a game, and he would just toss a bottle cap toward you because we would all have bottles of beer and stuff. Bottle caps would be laying around,
right?
And he would just toss them to you almost instinctively if you had a good role-playing moment or did something that he really thought impressive, and you could turn them in for various things. That evolved until today, where it's become, obviously, the hallmark of the show for rewarding you for good play. And in all different ways. And you are very stingy with them. You hold them back. Bottle caps are reserved for when you really earn it. You have to earn a bottle cap. It's not going to be easy. So that is
why... If I give
them
away all the time, they lose their meaning, Joe.
Exactly. So that is why we made bottle caps part of the Patreon reward system. So at the $15 tier, you're going to get mailed bottle caps all during the year. Official GCP bottle caps. At the time we put that together, to be honest, we did not have a fully fleshed out idea of exactly what that would be, though we did know some general aspects of it. Well, I brought this idea to you just before we started here, and I think you liked it.
I really liked it.
It is so perfectly nerdy and perfect. You guys are going to love this.
Okay, so this does not only go out to our Patreon supporters, I must say, because we absolutely cannot understate, which I say all the time, but I really, you guys are the best. I cannot understate how important you all are to us. Those of you that, I know there's those of you out there that want to support us on the Patreon and can't, and it is you guys who are going to get a chance through Cannon Fodder 50 to get yourselves some official bottle caps along with everybody else, because we're going to do a bottle cap giveaway courtesy of Cannon Fodder episode 50, but it's also going to be an explanation of what these things actually are.
This is going to get wild. Joe, yeah. we should have done this before you started drinking champagne. This is very complicated.
I'm already starting to forget everything.
And very exciting.
Okay, so the bottle caps themselves, originally the idea was to have the Glass Cannon logo on some bottle caps, and we had some of those made as prototypes. We gave a few away at GCP Live.
That's right.
To our GCP Live friends who came out to New York. Shout out to you guys. A couple of them walked away with some Glass Cannon bottle caps.
You can hear it on the live recording.
You can hear it on the live recording, but that was just tip of the iceberg, Troy, because the idea here was let's get a bunch of different GCP images on bottle caps and have a bottle caps of a wide variety. So here's the idea. The idea is we now make GCP bottle caps a collectible item. Collectible bottle caps.
Yes.
We are going to buy a large amount of bottle caps for our Patreon release. Those releases, when they are mailed out to people, are going to be random. Imagine getting a deck of magic cards, a booster pack, and just ripping it open. This is what you're going to get, a booster pack of bottle caps. Within there, you could have a wide range of different levels of rarity of bottle caps.
Yeah, let's talk about those levels. This is where the nitty gritty is.
So there are going to be black rimmed bottle caps with images like the Glass Cannon logo, maybe a couple original character portraits from back in the day from when Vanessa did our artwork, our penciled and inked artwork that will be common. Bottle caps.
So black is common.
Black is common. Now, some of you guys are going to start recognizing this because any World of Warcraft nerds out there or Diablo nerds out there, we're then going to have green-colored uncommon bottle caps.
Ah, what are those images going to be like? Give me a ball. Like, just make stuff up.
I hesitate to say too many, but possibly where I think it's going to be the Troy LaValle image, which came much later in the mix and was a Patreon-only release.
Patreon, okay.
So non-patrons could see this image of the Troy LaValle artwork.
Or maybe a colored-in version of some of the original black and white. It's a step up from the common.
Exactly. Ah. It's uncommon.
Okay.
Then blue is going to be rare.
Ah.
And now we're starting to get into some really more impressive images, some more impressive artwork that we've had over the years of GCP, some fan-submitted stuff that we have just highlighted and thought was incredible. Blue is rare.
So black common, green uncommon, blue rare. And as it gets closer to the top, there's going to be less of them made, right?
Exactly. Truly less of them made. Then we go to red, which is epic.
Red is epic.
And then finally, the tip of the iceberg is orange, which is legendary.
Oh, boy.
So I can tell you, I'm just kind of off the top of my head here, our first purchase of these bottle caps, which are going to go out in about a month from now, something like that. Yep. Including to the winners of the Cannon Fodder 50 contest. I think there's going to be about 1,300 bottle caps that we're purchasing to send out to people in that first shipment. Right. And of that 1,300, there's going to be 10 legendary bottle caps. Yeah, so just to give you an example of the range, and those of you that get those legendary bottle caps, man, do we want you to just take a picture of it, post it, because we're not even going to say what the images are on the epic and legendary bottle caps.
So these
you won't see pictures of those until people actually get them.
So these are mainly, we got these for to give to our Patreon subscribers at the $15 tier and up. They get the bottle cap reward. But we're going to do a contest. How many are we going to give away for this contest?
Okay, so for the contest...
And are they going to get any legendaries in the contest? That's crazy.
There are guaranteed legendaries in the contest.
Wow.
They're guaranteed every level in this Cannon Fodder 50 contest. And we're going to give away 50 bottle caps in this contest. But it's not going to be structured to 50 winners. It's going to be structured to 10 winners who will each get a random sampling, truly random sampling, of 5 bottle caps each.
Wow.
And the reason is because now we're getting into what is the contest in Cannon Fodder 50.
Yes.
So the contest is going to surround around, now what do we talk about on Cannon Fodder a lot, and in general with what the GCP has done for a lot of people over the years, it has promoted playing Pathfinder, if not promoted playing RPGs in general.
Right. Whether you've never played before or you played as a kid and just never played again, we hopefully brought you back in.
Exactly.
Or started you going to your hobby store and buying the game and starting to play.
And we hear from you guys all the time, and we hear these great stories, and we hear great epic tales of your games. We hear about, oh, I was nervous to start, and then I did, and it went really well. And we hear your questions, your in-depth and sometimes really insightful questions about what's difficult to play and not to play, or what's difficult to do with a player or not to do. Well, now it's time that we want to see you guys. We don't want to just hear from you guys. We want to see you guys. So the contest is really more of a random drawing.
Yes.
But in order to be available or eligible for the random drawing, here's what you're going to have to do. Troy, why don't you give it to him? Because, man, do you like complicated rules?
Oh, man. If we do anything consistently, it's really complicated contests. So just to kind of follow suit with everything else we've done, here's the idea. And you have to do all of the things I say, or you will not be eligible.
We have to earn a bottle cap.
You got to earn a bottle cap. That's the thing is, we want you to earn it. I give them out way too willy-nilly on the show.
Okay.
I want you guys to really earn it. So this is the plan. All you really got to do is take a picture of your next game session. Hopefully, you're playing Pathfinder, okay? In that picture, you need to have 3 things, really. You need to have your group, the GM,
human
the
beings.
Players. Human beings. Yeah. If you're playing on Roll20, take a screenshot. That totally works, too.
Yeah.
We know a bunch of people, especially on our Discord channel, are playing on Roll20. That's fine.
They screenshot or a screen cap works.
They have to be human beings in the photo showing GM players. Number 2, someone in that photo has to be holding up a piece of Pathfinder material. Whether it be the core rulebook, the bestiary, something. They have to be holding up an officially licensed Pathfinder product. We want to see you playing Pathfinder.
Well, I think that you could also be a little more creative than we're thinking. It might not necessarily have to be a book. It could just be something that says clearly, this is a Pathfinder item.
Maybe one of the goblin dolls we gave away at GCB Live.
Exactly.
Maybe
it's a mini of a Pathfinder monster or something. Anything that is officially Pathfinder.
Feel free to be creative, but if it's not Pathfinder, it's like on the cusp, you're out of the contest. It's got to be...
No bottle cap.
No bottle cap. And thirdly, just to make sure you're not just sending us a photo that you took months ago or years ago, you need to have someone in the photo holding up, very clearly, a D20.
So it could be more than one person, but it has to be at least one person.
Holding up a D20 that we can clearly see they are holding it up. Posing for the
camera. It could be a Troy D20 on a 20. It could be a Joe D20 on a 1. It's up to you.
That's up to you. We probably can't even see it because the D20 may not be that close to the frame, but we have to see that you're holding a D20. Don't show me a D8. You're out of the contest. So the 3 things it has to have, and then there's 2 other things. Well, these 3 things are...
I was just going to say, there's so many more things.
There's 2 other things. There's 5 things altogether, but the 3 first things are a photo of human beings in a group, GM and players. 2, someone has to be holding up a piece of Pathfinder material. 3, someone has to be holding a D20. It's so complicated. Deal with it. These are bottle caps. You got to earn it. And the last 2 things has to be on Twitter. Sorry. Can we send it on Facebook? No. Can we send an email? No. Has to be on Twitter. At Glass Cannon Pod. That's number 4. Hashtag GCP. That's number 5. Those are the 5 criteria.
So when you post it on Twitter, it has to have at Glass Cannon Pod on the post.
Yeah, when you send it out, at Glass Cannon Pod, send it to us.
Yep, and hashtag GCP. We want to get GCP trending.
We have never trended, we probably never will. This definitely won't do it. But at least people will be like, what's hashtag GCP? And they'll click on it and be like, oh my, look at this wonderful world I've discovered.
Yes, yes. That is true. But ultimately, really, what do we really want out of this is we want to see you guys. We want to see... Oh.
No, I thought you were
You're the worst. You are the worst. We want to see you guys. We want to see the pictures of our fans, our audience members that are out there playing games, and we're going to share them with everybody, and everybody's going to get to see everybody out there that is playing games and listening to the GCP.
That is a good point. If you send us this picture, we are going to post it on social media. So if you send it to us, just let us know. It is now ours to send out. We're not going to make t-shirts of it, but like, we're going to repost it. We might make a Facebook album with all these photos. We want people to see each other playing games.
Troy, now here's where Joe has to come in.
Oh boy.
Charlie Brown with the downer stuff.
Oh boy.
Here's where I come in and I say, Troy, I'm kind of in charge of the business end of this deal, and we're not going to be able to have the international people compete for the bottle caps.
Oh, we're so horrible to our international fans.
I know, and I'm not kidding, which is very unfortunate, but really, sorry guys, we want you to submit your pictures. Please still do.
We will repost those pictures.
We will absolutely repost those pictures. We will give you, Troy will speak fondly of you.
Yes, at dinner parties. All around Manhattan.
All around Manhattan, you will be spoken fondly of.
I found a wonderful picture from this gentleman from Norway the other day of him and his fourth form pals playing Pathfinder.
But due to the pain in the ass that is shipping and costs and all that stuff, we have to limit the actual bottle cap mailings to domestic fans only, unfortunately.
Now, how are we going to pick the winners? There's going to be 10 winners, and you said there's going to be one legendary in there? How many legendaries? Probably one.
I'm not commenting on how many legendaries. There's a guaranteed legendary.
So guaranteed at least one legendary in this mailing.
Guaranteed at least one legendary.
10 winners, 50 bottle caps, 10 winners with 5 bottle caps each. How are we going to pick them?
Well, part of the idea of getting... I'm not going to answer your question just yet, but part of the idea of getting it in the games is that... That's why we're going to give 5 bottle caps to one winner.
Yeah.
Whoever submits it, you are going to get this chance to get 5 bottle caps. And the idea is it's for your game.
Yeah.
So if you're a player, share it with your friends. If you're a GM, use it in your game. You could do whatever you want with it, really. You want it. You submitted the picture. But ultimately, it's all about using these bottle caps in your game. And I think it's safe to say, and I think you would agree, Troy, that as a GM, at any one point, you should have at least 5 bottle caps out to the players.
I don't.
I tried to draw you into that one.
That is 4 too many.
Fair enough. Okay, so how are we going to pick it? It's really just random because it's, you know, we thought about how to make it really subjective, and we don't want to judge everybody. We don't want to judge who has the best picture. We don't want to judge who has the coolest game. We don't want to
judge the most attractive players.
Right, exactly. We don't want to judge the people that dress up really well versus the people that are on Roll20. Like, that's not what it's about. It's just about seeing you guys playing. That's it, period. You submit that picture and do the At Glass Cannon Pod and hashtag GCP. You have the Roll20 or the D20 in the picture and a piece of Pathfinder material, and bam, you are in a random drawing, and we're going to randomly draw 10 of you to win 5 bottle caps each.
We couldn't make it more simpler.
More simpler. That's it. Well, I'll tell you what, Troy. In order to give back the only way we know how to our international fans, we're going to do an international listener mail.
Ooh, I'm going to have some more international Prosecco. Oh, that's the bottle, buddy.
That's it already?
Wow, that's the end of it. We finished all the Prosecco.
Ooh, man. We're going to have to nurse this through this listener mail because, honestly, guys, seriously, you know. Those of you out there that have dealt with us on the Patreon or dealt with us in the other contests that we've had, you know we feel terrible about not being able to ship to our international fans. We're very sorry about that. So the least that we can do right now is we wanted to put together a little bring back the listener mail international edition.
International!
International!
This is the least we can do.
So it's going to... So it's going to be 2 questions today. We're going to do a long cannon fodder.
Ooh, this is a long one.
First question is a good one and so much fun. And the second question is so incredibly hard that I don't even know how we're going to deal with it. But we're going to take it as it comes.
Okay.
So we're going to start off with a question from Nathan.
A softball.
A softball, I wouldn't say a softball, but a fun question for us to debate because you and I love doing this.
Mm.
This one comes from Nathan, who is in England, in the UK, and he writes in to ask, quote, what do you guys think about monks? Oh. I think he means Pathfinder monks, like role-playing monks, not
right.
like... real
like
monks.
Buddhist monks.
Yeah, I'm just going to assume he means role-playing monks.
Did he clarify? Because that's a big jump.
Oh, you know what? I didn't read the next sentence. Ah. He says, do you like the role-playing potential, yada, yada, yada. Okay.
Okay, okay, good, good.
Do you like the role-playing potential, or is it the lack of interesting weapons / spells boring to play? Have you ever played as a monk or been in a game with one? What was it like to interact with those characters, if so? I feel like with what's happened to Lork, not only not having his feet, but all of his gear ripped from him, the dependency on gear can be what holds characters back in combat. Having a fighter drop their weapon can be the death of them. Nathan, you are not wrong. We spoke last week, I believe, about Nestor's weapon almost getting sundered and how that would change the entire face of our party for an unknown, undetermined amount of time. Also, interestingly enough, one thing we didn't talk about in Cannon Fodder 50 proper tonight was the finding of Gorm's Thorn. The return of Lork's weapon and the gear and stuff like that. So we'll see where that goes. But I did like how Della was like, that belongs to a friend of mine.
Very
interesting.
He's good.
He's good.
He's good. He knows what he's doing.
He knows what he's doing. It's not his first rodeo.
And they found a broom.
Let's talk about monks, Troy. I'm going to start it with you. Have you ever played a monk? Have you ever played in a game with a monk? Do you like monks? What are your thoughts on monks?
This is a great topic for us to discuss because, correct me if I'm wrong, I love monks and you think they're stupid, terrible characters. classes.
It's not so black and white as that, but go on. Continue.
I love them. I love them. I've dabbled with a monk in our, like, we created what we called the Astoria Pathfinder Society, basically, here in Queens, where we just, when we weren't playing in one of our campaigns because somebody couldn't show up or whatnot, we would just get a bunch of people together and play a Pathfinder scenario. So we had a bunch of different characters that we would use in those scenarios. Skid would GM, I would GM, Joe would GM, our buddy Tom would GM. We would just kind of mix it up. And I created a monk for that. And it was my first dabbling with a monk since D&D 2nd Edition, which is, I don't even remember. I found my original character sheet from that from forever ago, over 20 years ago. And it's like looking at that character sheet is like trying to read Sanskrit. I can't understand it at all. But I love the Pathfinder monk, and I also understand why people don't like it. It's a very complicated class. You can't wear armor. You know, you're like, oh, just wear amulets of natural armor. You can't get those until you have a ton of money. You know,
dude, when you start out, no joke, your AC is like 12 or 13 at best.
And as a monk, you have to be up in the face of the creatures you're fighting.
Right, you're not a wizard.
Right, so
you're not standing in the back casting stuff.
It's very, very difficult.
Shooting a crossbow.
Class to play. You know, they become literally one with nature at level 20, where they can, like, stop time with their, I think they could do this thing called, like, it's similar to Featherfall, where they just fall.
Down a wall.
Fall down a wall very slowly.
Forever.
Like,
and not,
using their finger to bounce. I mean, but no one ever gets to level 20, but. I think why I like the monk so much is it's a very difficult class to play, and I enjoy the challenge. Like, they made an Unchained monk when Pathfinder Unchained came out. They kind of, I think they thought they were not so much correcting the problems with the original monk, but offering a little bit more powerful version of the monk. Like, the monk at level one, a hand-to-hand combatant, for the most part, depending on what archetype you use, starts out with a +0 BAB, you know. But because of Flurry of Blows, you can get multiple attacks at first level, so it balances out. The Unchained Monk starts with a +1 to their BAB. And I
don't
played
understand.
Both.
I never understood why they didn't start out with a +1. They are a martial class.
It's because of Flurry of Blows.
Yeah.
It really is well-balanced. Like, I think probably Pathfinder purists would totally disagree with me, but I enjoy the challenge. Like, I played the Unchained Monk. I tried an Unchained Monk, and I tried the regular Monk. I actually liked, I mean, I liked the damage I did and the more frequent hitting that I did with the Unchained Monk, but I like the, I would love to play Rune Lords one day as a monk and take it from like first to however high you go in.
Yeah, I'm sure you would, but the problem is you can't live that long.
Well, you can't.
I'm not even kidding. No, you can't. What do you mean play him smart? He has no ranged attacks. You're standing right in the middle of all the combat with no armor, no AC, against creatures that are all higher BAB than you, that are using vicious, vicious weapons. You know, I mean, here's my... Okay, let me get into my problem with the monk.
Okay.
Okay, as a theoretical character, as a story narrative character, one of my favorites. Absolutely, without question. A class that I would love to play. And it's not just about damage output. It's about, I love the focus and the centering and the martial art of focusing the energy in the body and then getting to a level where literally your attacks become magical. Just your attacks are magical. I have no problem waiting for that. That's amazing. Yeah. I'm saying that mechanically, the class is broken in a bad way, which is why they did Monk Unchained. They didn't do it to experiment with something new. No, they did Unchained for the ones that stunk, for the ones that were broken because they were too weak to actually live. Not broken because they didn't do a lot of damage. Broken because they didn't survive to higher levels. Look at the Summoner. That was another one they did. Unchained Summoner. Why do you think that was? Because nobody played Summoners. Because the way the mechanics of the Eidolon worked, it just didn't really work.
It's a complex class. I just would... Here's the thing, though. I think that
Hold on, let me ask, spoiled. Excuse me, sir.
Okay.
Sir,
please. Remind me to pick up my idea with you being spoiled. But continue.
I just want to ask you real quick.
Yeah.
Your monk, did he not almost die in every single session? I mean, like, seriously, you thought he was dead in the next round in every single session?
There was a lot of near-death situations.
Did you not believe that there were times when the GMs you played with in PFS kept him alive when they should have killed him?
No comment.
Yep, there were two times, at least, that he was dead, and the GM, by his very generous nature, let him live.
Yeah.
So it is a fault of the class. It's not a fault of the player. It's not a fault of the idea of the class. It's not a fault of the unarmed or unarmored idea. It's just the way that it fleshed out in Pathfinder did not work mechanically. And if you played strictly by the numbers, that character could not make it to fourth level. Couldn't.
Sure, but like I also probably played a little bit more...
recklessly?
Throw caution to the windish because I knew the GM would be a little bit forgiving of
fair enough.
Just general.
Know your GM.
So, yeah, know your GM. But here's why I say you're spoiled, because I think people just assume that like a first level character is a god. You know, I like the idea of the monk. I think the monk path, taking a month from first to as far as you can go with it, is much more realistic journey of a hero. Because a first level Pathfinder core rulebook monk is like a white belt in karate. You know what I mean? And if you put a white belt in karate up against a dragon, he is going to die immediately. If you put a white belt in karate up against two thugs with very little fighting training, he's still going to have a really hard time and may not make it out of that fight. So I think that if you want to play a monk, you just got to play him like he can't be a hero at first level. You've got to play him smart. And then eventually he's going to get to a point where he can do crazy damage.
The one thing that really comes out a lot as a downfall of the monk mechanically as a character is that to do what you say, which you're not wrong, that's what you need to do at early levels. But in order to do that, that means you need to avoid combat. In order to avoid combat, straight out combat, you need to have a certain level of either charisma or dexterity, let's say, to kind of get away from stuff. This brings up one of the main problems with the mechanics of monks, which is that they are dependent on every ability more than every other class. They must have
strength, con, and dex for sure.
Con, dex, charisma, intelligence, because they need skill points, and wisdom.
Yeah, I think wisdom is tied into their like bonuses on
right, exactly. Yeah, so that is one of their weaknesses per the main rules of the game. Mm-hmm. And that's disappointing to me because I think that all characters should be reliant on all the skills in some way or another. I don't like the dump stat. I don't like that. But there is like, there's something to be said for the idea of the group in Pathfinder, right? Mm-hmm. You have your companions can shore up your weaknesses. With a monk, there's no, if you power game in any area, the monk becomes so useless with some of his given abilities in those other areas that you dumped ability points that the monk just seems to me like more of a lone adventurer, and it doesn't work well with another group because he's kind of a bit of everything, which is not a good thing when you're a specialized adventuring group. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I just think I'm surprised that you would see that as a drawback. I think it's only a drawback because 90% of the other classes aren't built that way. You can kind of dump three stats, whereas the monk, you really can't. Maybe you can dump one or two, but that's kind of the class that everything we preached since day one is more what we're interested in. Like, you have to build a well-balanced character. He may not be a hero, and he's going to be...
No, I agree.
And you know what you were saying? He's going to be kind of a lone wolf, but that's kind of what the monks are. I think of, like, David Carradine in the Kung Fu series. Like, he's... Yeah. How that guy fits into a group is obviously going to come out in the role playing, but yeah, in combat, it's very, very difficult at those low levels for him to be super effective without putting himself at death's door every single time. I mean, I know from experience that my monk went unconscious almost every single encounter until he was third level.
Yeah, it is not difficult for him to be super effective. It's difficult for him to do absolutely anything that his class offers in any way without putting himself on death's door. he doesn't wield a crossbow. Even as a wizard, you're extremely weak at first level. There are some things you can do to avoid this. Yeah. There's nothing with a monk. There's nothing that you can do. You must be in hand-to-hand combat with no defense. Now, you can do fighting defensively all the time, miss all the time, which is fine, and stay alive, maybe. So that is my concern. My concern is not, I want to do power damage. My concern is not, I don't want to have such a well-balanced character and ability scores. No, my concern is, I don't think I can live till fourth level with this character. That is my concern. And that's not even bringing up the big issue, which is combat maneuvers.
Yeah.
Let's not even... Do you want to even open that door right now? Because, man,
I mean, we'll never get to the next question. But this is another point of contention between you and I. Like, you think that combat maneuvers are a waste of time as a PC.
Mechanically broken.
Whereas I think it's only considered that way because most people don't want to forfeit their seven attacks with their sword to try and do a grapple that will almost definitely miss.
Yes. And that is not, it's just not good
gaming. And provokes an attack of opportunity unless you have improved
grapple.
It's just
not good gaming. It's not smart. It's actually going to factor into our next question a little bit so that this is a little bit of a transition. But it's not about just playing the game to its most tactical. It is the fact that I think that there's a problem with the system. I think there's a problem with the system there that needs to be addressed. And maybe I'm just missing something. Maybe grappling someone or tripping someone or bull rushing someone is so powerful that it should be extremely rare to happen. But in my experience, it has never been that powerful that it is that rare to happen. That you have to spend a feat on it for it to ever be even remotely usable seems silly to me, and I want to encourage it. So I will oftentimes, in my games, I will ease up on those rules a little bit. I'll make it a little bit easier for you to get a grapple. I won't pull, have you provoke an attack of opportunity on a bull rush or something like that just because you want to try something fun. You want to push somebody into a river. Just give it a shot. That's great. Let's just do it. Rather than making it so mechanically ridiculous for a first or second level character to do that you never do it. Because I think it's fun to use combat maneuvers. Like, really, really fun. But it just doesn't... you always fail.
Well, I think that you should have to spend the feats for them. Almost all the monsters that I am controlling, even in our campaign, have things like improved sunder, improved overrun, stuff. And I think that if you want to build a character that can do something like that, don't try to do all of it. You know, you don't want to have asunder and overrun and, you know, all this other stuff. But I think there's something to be said for going, choosing one path. I'm going to be a tripper. That's what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to build myself up to be able to trip. I'm not always going to be able to do it, but you're also not always going to be able to hit the enemies that you swing your sword at. But once in a while, you will be able to do it. Maybe not at first level, maybe at sixth, seventh.
How'd that work out for all your monsters so far?
Well, I don't use it a lot.
I'm not even shit talking. I'm serious. Your monster feats have led you to nothing.
Well,
led
I don't use it. I don't
every combat.
I don't use it a lot. I mean, I'll use the improved grapple feat to avoid the attack of opportunity when one of my creatures grabs you guys in its jaws or something like that. But you know, I used Sunder on Nestor last week,
and it didn't work. Well, didn't do anything.
It was 1 point away from breaking his weapon.
But just another example, like it didn't work again.
Right, but if I had Sundered again the next round, destroyed Beau.
Maybe. Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely destroyed Beau because you did the damage.
Yeah, I did. I think it was 25 hit points, and I gave it 12.
Yeah.
So it was 1 point away from being broken.
Yeah.
And one more attack away from... Listen, it's one of those things like we talked about in weeks before. If your players want to get creative and spread out the room or do things that are a little off the cuff, then you as a GM need to pull back and let them do those things. So in the same way, it's like... I would not lessen and allow people to do combat maneuvers more easily like you do. I'm always the one in the games to be like, actually, Joe, that provokes an attack of opportunity because I want it to be hard. But if someone really wants to commit to being a combat maneuver specialist, go for it. But really do it right. It's not going to work all the time. And it's going to frustrate you for a long time. I guess what I'm going to say about the monk, and this is going to be my last word on it, is like there are a bunch of players out there who will hate everything that the monk is about. You will not enjoy playing a monk, and there's no way you'll ever enjoy playing a monk. But there are other players out there that will love the challenge. And I'm not saying that like the other people who wouldn't like it don't like a good challenge. I'm just saying there are some people like me who just really enjoy that sort of masochism of struggling your way through a difficult class and figuring it out as you go along.
Fair enough. That is going to bring us to our next question, which really does tie in really well here, because I could argue on and on and on about how the I enjoy the spirit of the monk. I want to play a monk, probably more than any other class. I don't get...
Really?
Yeah, I don't get my high off of great weapons or weaponry or great armor. That's not my thing. I really love the idea of the martial artist. I love the idea of magic from within. I love the idea of the Neo in the Matrix, like that is
mysticism.
That to me is just so much fun. I think that mechanically in the game, it is broken against you to such an extent that you can't even really play your imagination because of the rules. That's why I don't like a monk. Mm-hmm. That brings me to this terrific email that we got from Daniel in Stockholm in Sweden.
Oh,
Daniel, thank you so much for writing in. This is a great email. It's barely even a question, really. I mean, it is a question, but it's not something that's particularly difficult to answer. It's just a conversation starter, really, which is, he says, I just wanted to ask you a question about role playing in the States compared to in other places, if you know anything about that. Spoiler alert, we don't. I usually divide pen and paper RPGs into two categories, game-based and immersion-based. I would categorize games such as Pathfinder, D&D, and so on as game-based RPGs. Rules are very important. It's very game-y, with five-foot steps and points for skills and such. It's my impression that these kind of games are what is mainly being played in the States. It is my bias that if I were to ask a random American nerd what would be most important, a game rule set or a game's lore or world building, 8 out of 10 would answer that the rules are the more important thing that they're focusing on. Here, at least in Sweden, it is my impression that it is the opposite. We tend not to go into such depths with the rules, or rather, we prefer simplified rules that don't, quote-unquote, get in the way of story, if you know what I mean. The world, atmosphere, lore, and setting is more important to us. Or at least that's how I see it, having asked around. Personally, I prefer immersion and storytelling rather than advanced rules and hour-long combat encounters when I am a DM, as it fits better with how I like to lead the game. Though I want to be clear that I think both types are very fun with the right group. Now, I have to admit, you guys are actually the first group that I've followed that actually seem to mix the two pretty well. Thank you very much. I've been very fascinated to see how into the story you are, and that has challenged my impressions of role-playing stereotypes. So I wanted to write you guys and ask you for your opinions on the matter. With you, would you agree with some of my assessments, or am I just way out there?
Whew, that's a big one. I mean, I like that he said that we are, you know,
Mixing the two,
because I don't think you can have one without the other. But I know there are groups out there that are one way or the other. That there are groups that just sit there and rules lawyer the entire session, and it's just got to be
into
headachy,
oblivion,
and they
misery, where everyone is miserable.
Everyone's miserable, but they still love it because it's just one up. I'm gonna one up you. I'm gonna one up you. Right. I'm a munchkin, and like. I understand that, and I think that that's probably the American stereotype. It's like shaking their books up in the air. But I mean, I don't think I would never be interested in a game that didn't marry the two. I think that you have to have both, and it's very interesting to think that that's like is he setting it up as like that's the European ideal, that it's got to be more focused on story.
So less focus on rules. They like simplified rules and more immersion, more story as the focus.
That's interesting. I mean, he's from Sweden?
Sweden, Stockholm, yeah. Yes.
Stockholm. Stockholm. Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah, no, honestly, I think that I don't really know what the general style is in America or in Europe, I will say, because I'm only in New York. I've only really played in New York. I played in Philly when I was a kid, but now I just play in New York. I don't have the overall overarching experience that, you know, would inform me to answer this question properly. But what do I think of your assessment? I think it's very interesting. And I think that regardless of if you're talking about this location or that location, it's a classic debate in the RPG realm. It's a it comes back a lot of times to even something as mundane and irritating to even talk about as edition wars and stuff like that, mm-hmm. where people say, do you play D&D 5e or do you play Pathfinder? I don't like Pathfinder because of all the crunchy rules. Well, I like Pathfinder because those crunchy rules help to define the story in such a better way than a game where you're just making everything up on the fly and there's no rules to it. I know people that read fantasy novels that love fantasy novels that are so completely out there that there's no attachment to reality in any way, that they enjoy the complete unlimited imagination, let's say, of it. And that's to put it in the best light that I can. And then there are others that say the best fantasy or magic worlds that I have ever seen built are the ones that are the strictest on magic and great beasts and dragons and what they can do and what they can pull off and whatever, how the heroes are limited. That is what defines a good story. So I see both sides of the debate, but the reason that I will say I fall down on the more rules-heavy side of the debate is because in the grand scheme of things, I would always put story and immersion ahead of rules 100% of the time. But I have a healthy respect for how much the rules define the story. When you use the rules to define the limits of the story, you have the essence of struggle, which is the essence of what makes the hero's journey what it is. Just like we were talking about with the monk. You said building the monk makes for the ultimate hero's story. I say the rules make it impossible for the monk to survive that tale.
You and at the end of the day, the dice are fate.
Right. And you say, let's look back. You say, I stare that comment in the face and I scoff at it. And I say, I will overpower you. That monk is more of a hero for playing by those really intense, crunchy rules and surviving than by playing by the rules of a friendly GM who's your best buddy, who gives you some resistance now and then, but really just lets you be the hero. That's not a real hero's tale. Sorry to bust up your party, but the real hero's tale is when you fight against something insurmountable. And sometimes these really, really in-depth rules seem insurmountable, but That's why I feel like they tie in with that classic tale.
Everyone, especially you, wanted Lork to hit General Kargik when he came running in.
That would have been better story, in my opinion, right? You, but before what happened.
Right.
That would have been better story.
You were upset about that for weeks after that recording. You were just so bummed. And all I could think to myself was like, that story, man. Like, obviously you would love in that moment for that to happen. But look at the journey that it's pushed Lork on. And I mean, that's where the rules create. I said the dice is fate. The dice is like allowing you to have no control over where the story goes.
Right.
You know, what's the old adage? It's like when you make plans, God laughs.
Yeah.
Or something like that. It's the same thing. It's like you can have all the intentions of the world, but the rules are going to make it go wherever it wants to go.
Yeah, I love... did you see on Netflix the Siege of Jadotville?
No.
Did you watch this? It's with your boy, who you cast as Finial Smith. Smick.
Smick.
Finial Smick. Jamie Dornan? Is
Jamie
that
Dornan, yeah.
Yeah, so he plays the lead in this Netflix original film about an Irish... A true story about an Irish army... contingent that was sent to Africa in the 60s for a peacekeeping mission for the UN.
I wonder if my casting of him in episode 100 got him this gig.
It might have.
Word was out there.
Anyway, I highly recommend it. It's actually a really good movie, and he has there's a moment where he talks to a French officer in Africa who's down there with his army, and he just says, very simply, he says, he's quoting a, I think it's Goebbels, he's quoting a German tactician from World War II. He says, no plan survives contact with the enemy. So it's just, you can have all the best laid plans in the world, but as soon as there's contact, boom, everything goes to chaos. Now, there is a certain amount of training, instilled training in people that can have them act in certain ways to keep things running almost with unconscious effort in the right direction. And that's why we train. That's what training is for. But the fact of the matter is that it gets haywire. It goes all over the place. And to feel like you don't have that control as a player, and to feel as the GM, like you can enforce a set of rules as your control rather than just your whim, it just feels more genuine to me.
Yeah. I mean, the idea, this is a collaborative story. And that story is being shaped not only by the imaginations of the players, but by an intensely complex set of rules that is ever-evolving and ever-changing and usually remembered by the players at the table.
I mean, 10% of the time.
I can't think of any other... I always hesitate to call what we do or this kind of thing as an artistic form. But let's just, for the sake of argument, say that it is an artistic form. I can't think of a single other artistic form that has such a strict adherence to rule systems. Do you know what I mean? Like, you could say, oh, a film does. Are you kidding me? There's avant-garde films out there. They're making innovations in how they make films every single day. Oh, theater. Well, you got to... they can't leave the stage. The fourth wall. They break the fourth wall at a time. The cast is in the audience. They're out on the street taking the audience up on a march. I mean... in this form, we're doing collaborative improvisation with battles and everything and a crazy rule set. I mean, I honestly think, in answer to your question, the long answer to your question, my Swedish friend, is that you cannot have one without the other. And I challenge you people out there who listen to the show and are playing games on your own to, if you see one side of your game is lacking, really work hard to bring up that other side, and you're going to have a much better time when you find that harmony.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. If you are immersing yourself so far in story, but you find yourself easing up on the rules, try to bring the rules back. Your story's already good. Try to bring the rules back and let them be, don't think of them as obstacles to good story. Think of them as obstacles of your character in the story.
Right.
You know, those are two very, it sounds very similar, but those are two very different things. If you are sitting around the table and all you're doing is breaking every couple minutes to read for 5 minutes to look up all the rules, and you're bored with the story and the, and you're not getting emotional connection to the characters, okay, you have to focus back on the story. You have to focus back on the characters. I 100% agree that you can't have one without the other, but I'll quote Nick Lowe here, who back in the day when I challenged him on this very debate, working in with artists and writers, he would tell me that part of his job as an editor was to keep those writers in the box. Keep them in the lines. Any writer that was like, I'm going to go outside of the box with this, he's like, that sounds really sexy, but it usually doesn't work. And the people that are the most successful are the people that stay in the box to a certain extent and are just work it so well that they do things no one ever expected or could have thought of. And I argued him at the time. I debated very strongly that, you know, I was in my 20s. I was in that time in your life when you're like, I don't want to do anything like anyone else does it. I don't want to do things by the book. I don't want to do things by the rules. And he said, that's a very kind of immature, but that sounds really offensive, but it's a very immature, for lack of a better word. I don't have the better word right now, way to think about things. The
inexperienced.
Inexperienced way to think about things, because if you do fall within the lines, but you still manage to create something that no one else created, you are bound for way, way more success than just that random roll of the dice of going outside the box, which does sometimes hit, but usually is only a flash in the pan.
Yeah.
So in general, I would say, to answer your question, no, we don't really know the difference between the two. I've never really known a lot of European gamers. Unfortunately, that is a deficiency that I have. I also don't even know a whole lot of American gamers besides you guys. I mean, I don't even play regularly in a game with a woman. I would love to play regularly in a game with a woman. We don't have any that we know that regularly play with us. And so there is that, like, that disconnect to a different styles of playing, which I would be interested to see. But from our seat right here, I do think that you can have both in spades, and I think that they feed off of each other all the time. And but yeah, I will say, though it does sound like we're arguing heavily for rules-based, heavy rules-based RPG gaming, that there are times when I get a little exhausted with over-rule lawyering, and I'm not into that either. So it's all about balance.
Yeah, and the main point is, like, if you think the rules are hindering your creativity, if you think a pre-written adventure path is hindering your creativity, you need to rethink your creativity.
Right.
You know, that's just, I'm going to leave it at that.
Yep, I think that is well said. I will restate it as, if you think the rules are not letting you do what you want to do, that's different from the rules than you working within the rules to do anything, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Just because it's not what you want to do doesn't mean it's stopping you from doing the best thing. What you want to do is not always the best thing.
Right.
What I wanted for Lork is not what happened. But right now, I think it is the best thing for this story, the way it is happening.
Yeah.
So, and those are the rules, you know?
Man, but what would have happened if he had just killed Kargik?
If he critted on
this
charge?
This story would be completely different.
It would.
But man, sign me up for the story we're telling.
Any day of the week. All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed Listener Mail International Edition.
International.
Troy, we did end up killing that bottle of champagne for Cannon Fodder 50, bro.
It's gone. The Prosecco's gone. I just poured a little drop into my glass. That's it.
That is it.
Wow.
Guys, we are so excited for your submissions. Please get those pictures in. Get them tweeted out. We want to send you out some of these collectible GCP bottle caps, which we are very excited to release. I am so excited for
this. I think it's
going to be
so
fun.
Only good idea you've ever had.
I've had a few. In my time, this is one of them.
This is the longest Cannon Fodder, and it's number 50. This is special.
This is what it should have been. And honestly, I cannot believe that we are this far into this episode. It's flown by for me. I don't know about you.
And now we get to get ready for episode 105.
Which Troy says is going to be one of the best episodes that we have had.
I now, a couple of glasses of Prosecco in, regret making that.
I'm going to hold you to it, buddy. I'll see you in 105.